The Guardian.
During March, The Guardian's podcasts are sponsored by audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/free download to find out more.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Man City, Chelsea. We ask, was it right to field a striker who for months on end simply wouldn't do his job? And aside from Torres, what about Carlos Tevez? How did he get on? There's all the midweek results, the Gunners overtaking Spurs in the race for third, Liverpool breaking clear in the race for seventh, and the battle at the bottom featuring that 750-1 comeback. We look forward to the weekend action in the Premier League and on the continent too. Bundesliga, Serie A and Liga. Are Real Madrid beginning to bottle it? All that plus posts, tweets and more. And this Sunday's European final in London in Football Weekly Extra. Well, hello everybody and welcome back me. And welcome back as well, Paul Doyle.
Hi, hi James.
Hi Paul, lovely to see you.
You too.
Been a while.
Indeed.
Been up to all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
All right then. Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
Hi, Paolo. And welcome back, Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Hi, Raphael. Everything well with you?
Yeah.
All right then. Who saw the big game Wednesday night at the Etihad? Hands shoot towards the ceiling, listeners. Raphael, how about that finale? City looked like the title had been lost with about 20 minutes to go. And then...
Then
there was that dramatic turnaround and that.
There was, yeah. Carlos Tevez.
Carlos Tevez, that's it. Do you know, despite playing only 24 minutes, no player in Man City Chelsea created more chances than Carlos Tevez.
It was very cagey. I think Chelsea didn't at all look like a team who had, I suppose, spring in their step after this fantastic turn in their fortunes with the Napoli game and then winning against Leicester. They still played the same old, fairly tired stuff they've been playing for most of the season.
Elements of the team certainly did look leggy. One or two players, though, did have a certain spring in their step. David Luiz, for example, no? Fernando Torres as well, I thought.
Well, he was quite cheesed off when he got substituted and the way things turned afterwards, you could sort of... imagine how he could be even more cheesed off with that by the end of the match. Yeah, you know, he's... But this has been the conversation all season with Torres, hasn't it? I mean, well, maybe not all season, but certainly for a while we've been saying, look, here's a guy who's playing well, he's contributing things to the team, but he just doesn't score. And while I don't think you can necessarily have a big go at him for not scoring in this game, not many teams players score a lot of goals at City, he didn't score.
No, he didn't. But anyway, City then, they bring on Tevez... And this game that looked like it was slipping away from them and with it their title chances becomes a major stepping stone perhaps towards potentially the championship, Paolo.
Yeah, very possibly. I think it certainly, it feels like the sort of result that gives you a lift to come back in that circumstance and being down by a goal. It's a really difficult thing with Tevez, isn't it? I just find it difficult not to sort of see a lot of hypocrisy in the situation of now wanting to laud this guy when there's a lot of people who've really been out to you know, kick him during all this, and probably rightly. You know, he behaved in a pretty immature way, looking at it from the outside anyway. And now to sort of turn around and go, oh, hooray, this guy's going to show up and he's going to win us the title. I don't know, it feels a bit not right.
You're not happy with it?
Well, I don't, you know, look, football's a business in the end. I don't blame the team for being pragmatic about it and saying we've got to win, you know, we want to win things. It's not something that I particularly feel inclined to laud. Oh, great, this guy who felt like taking several months off from his employer in the middle of the season and basically tried to bully his way into getting what he wanted. Now he's back and we have to go and say, oh, great, he's a hero.
Well, that's what Zlatan does every season, isn't it?
Yeah.
He takes a few months off. Doesn't it really bode well for City, though? Because, you know, in Balotelli, they already have a fairly inconsistent performer. Dzeko hasn't really been as much as he should have been, in my estimation. And now they've just got another option. So I think, I mean, you can level all sorts of accusations at Mancini's door, perhaps. He hasn't really made the team as a whole work as well as they should have done. But if you can just throw on extra players when things don't work for you, extra players of real quality, it might just be enough. I mean, United, their closest challengers, they haven't looked like a great team either. So having those one or two players, even if they haven't played for most of the season, come in for 30 minutes and come up with some... spark that might be enough to win it this year. It's been a strange season, and you know, I don't think we'll be hailing this City team necessarily if they do win the title, but I don't think the City fans and Mancini will care too much.
If it is a case of just throwing lots of good players at it, could any manager have got City where they are now?
I don't know about Well, I don't know about that. I tended to think with Mancini in Italy, certainly, and he won a lot in Italy at a time when it was, you know, there weren't a lot of other teams challenging him to win a lot. I thought there was an extent to which his achievements were overstated slightly. And I also thought at Inter sometimes he came across as a very self-indulgent manager. And a couple of times where he's basically got in a huff and tried to resign and then went to Moratti's office and Moratti would talk him down. And it always felt like he was just trying to make it all about him again. But to be honest, I don't know if I have got that impression with him at City. I think he may have grown up as a manager as well.
Would self-indulgence help explain how long it took to resolve the Carlos Tevez thing?
I don't know. Again, look, it's a tough one to know exactly how these conversations are going on behind closed doors. But it did seem to me like Mancini, with his, you know, there was that whole incident, wasn't there, where he invited Tevez round to his house, and Tevez came at, you know, whatever it was, 10 at night, and they ended up sitting there and having this long conversation. But Tevez still refused to apologise. I don't know. It feels like he tried. He tried in that instance at least to try and resolve this in a better way. But, you know, it hasn't happened.
What do you think he did that was self-indulgent? Perhaps going public with it in the first place. Do you think he should have tried harder to bring...
Yeah, if, as he now seems to be saying, Tevez is integral to their hopes of winning the title, then you have to try harder. That's your job.
Any parent will tell you that if you reward a Spartan and brattish toddler, they will only be more Spartan and brattish.
Well, Man United might win the title because Ferguson rewarded Wayne Rooney.
Well, it all depends, I guess, what's more important.
And actually, there was a story about Mourinho at Inter that Schneider told about how, you know, he was feeling particularly jaded at one point and he wasn't doing very well in training and he thought Mourinho was going to have a big go at him. What Mourinho said was, take a break, go to the beach. And he said, you know, Schneider said, and ever since then, I'd kill for this man, I'd die for this man. So maybe sometimes it is the most, it's his language, not mine, but it's, you know, maybe sometimes it is the best solution as a manager to indulge it. But I don't know, for me, the way this whole Tevez thing's played out, for him now to sort of get to come back and be the hero leaves a bit of a bad taste.
Well, that's it, because you either make it a point of principle or you resolve it quickly. He's done neither.
I agree, and a lot of the talk at the time when Mancini took his hard line against Tevez was very laudatory of his position, how well he'd handled it, etc. But to a large extent, what he's doing now completely gives the lie to that. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Can I just say on Mancini quickly, I did really enjoy, I can't remember which goal it was, after the first or second, but there was a very enjoyable celebration from him on the sideline. Yeah, it was fat bloke in the audience at dart celebration, punching one fist into the air after the other. It was really fun.
The fact that Tevez has now apologised, you could say, gives Mancini perfect licence to reintegrate him into the side.
But did he mean the apology?
Well, isn't it more important that he apologised and he recognises the need to apologise?
Well, he recognised the need to apologise. Yeah.
Right. Well, OK, it's all very interesting, isn't it? Rafa?
Yeah, I mean, Paul, you question whether a team could win it without a manager, but I think Chelsea showed us that not having a manager around doesn't always work. I mean, they left John Terry at home. And it backfired for them in that game.
Well, no, I didn't.
Tom Terry, assistant manager.
I didn't say without a manager. I said with any manager.
Any manager. Anyway, now, also interesting is the fact that City could well be back on top of the pile, putting pressure on United by the time Sir Alex Ferguson's men take to the field on Monday night in their game at home to Fulham at Old Trafford. So this weekend, City are at Stoke. Win that, and the pressure back on their neighbours. Stoke showing a little bit of life there. A little bit of fire, if you like, in their game at White Hart Lane. Late come back from Spurs. And what's happened to Spurs then? Paolo Bandini, big Spurs fan. 1 point in four.
Yeah, I mean, it is strange, isn't it? Because I think if you looked at some of the games in that, you know, disappointing run...
Don't say they played well.
Well, they did. You know, they have played well in some of those games. And this game, they didn't. Well, again, I suppose it all depends how you colour it, but they certainly didn't feel anywhere near as fluid as they have been at times this season. They certainly... Because they had like 17 shots and they dominated like 70% of possession, but they didn't really, aside again from one fantastic Bale shot that struck the bar, really incredible shot, that would have been a fantastic goal, they didn't really look that much like scoring for a lot of the game. And look, I know this is the characterisation certainly of this Stoke side, is they're, you know, they're organised and they're strong and they're going to make life hard for you to break them down, and that's what they did. And there was a lot of credit due there as well, but... Tottenham did sort of, after sort of being able to say in this recent run, well, we've done some things well, we've played well in some of these games, this was the time when you looked at it and thought, well, actually, they weren't that special this time, and maybe they didn't deserve to get away with more than the draw, even despite all that possession.
I think Spurs have looked a little bit jaded in recent weeks. The tempo of their play has just slowed down very slightly, and so they missed, for example, Aaron Lennon last night, who would have reintroduced a bit of dynamism to it. And I didn't see the game last night, so I don't know if Modric...
You were at Loftus Road, weren't you?
I was, yeah. Mm. So I don't know where Bale was playing.
All over the shop.
Was it, yeah. That innovation hasn't really worked. When he's been cutting off... I mean, when you've got a guy who was one of the best left-sided attackers in the world, make him attack down the left rather than wander all over the place and get Modric's way.
I actually think this is a really interesting point, because I think that what I heard Bale talking about when he explains it is, oh, well, you know, we switch flanks sometimes. This is a useful facet to the game. And I think that's fair enough if what you're doing is actually for a period switching flanks. But what he seems to do is not that. He seems to sort of start from the left and then just drift all over the place, which is not the same thing as saying, right, we're going to switch flanks. I'll do 10 minutes on the right, and that'll, you know, give them something else to think about.
Mm. Yeah. Indeed. Do you think Stoke are going to cause Man City problems on the weekend? Is Carlos Tevez going to play?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
I think Man City will beat Stoke simply because they will have 75% of the possession, and I think they have enough ingenuity in there to conjure at least one goal scoring chance. I think Stoke won't.
Okay, Vincent Kompany due to be back as well, which could prove a major asset in those meaty kind of aerial 6-yard box battles at the Britannia. And now Arsenal, meantime, have gone past Spurs with that draw for Tottenham at White Hart Lane. Arsenal with a win at Everton, given Everton's recent record there at Goodison Park. Pretty impressive stuff. You must be delighted, Paolo.
Yeah, obviously. I think I'm the only person who's going to talk about Arsenal and Tottenham. Look, it's a good result. Still, Tottenham have easily the most favourable run-in out of those three teams, Arsenal, Tottenham and Chelsea.
Really?
Yep, because Arsenal's still got to play Chelsea and Manchester City. Obviously, Chelsea have got to play Tottenham and they've got to come away to Arsenal. Now, Tottenham-Chelsea this weekend is going to be a very big game, clearly, but there's a tendency for lots of fans, understandably, after the mind the gap gags that were going on when Tottenham were 10 points clear, to get very excited about it. I think it was a very good result for Arsenal, albeit Everton were extremely unlucky with them. A very, very clearly onside goal that was ruled out. But it's, you know, it's a great result to win at Everton, and Arsenal are on the crest of a wave right now, but there's still quite a lot of games left.
It must be the stuff of Spurs nightmares. You're 13 points clear, I think, at one point of Arsenal. I mean, with games in hand and all that.
Well, I think it was when they were leading 2-0 at Emirates Stadium, they were sort of notionally 13 points clear.
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, and then now what? 1 point behind. Mm. And in the midst of what was their best season in the Premier League, they're now behind an Arsenal team who are in the middle of a slump. What does that say?
Yeah, and this bothered me a little bit on Match of the Day when they were talking about, I think it was Alan Hansen saying, oh, well, I think Tottenham deserve to be in the Champions League season. Well, Tottenham will deserve to be in the Champions League season if after 38 games they are there. And I think they will be, for the record. I think Tottenham, for me, I still think are going to finish third. Mm. But you don't make these calculations after 16 games. You make them after 38.
Have that, Alan Hansen. Now, you mentioned Chelsea-Spurs this weekend. What a big game that is, Raphael. You're going along, aren't you?
I am, yes. Yeah. I'm really excited. And, of course, the odds are very much stacked in Tottenham's favours. I think it's easy to overlook that they're still 5 points clear, so a draw would be a great result for them. Mm. You know, it's not impossible. The way that Chelsea have been playing, I think the midfield, you know, Chelsea's midfield still doesn't function at all. Their strike force, you could say, depends who's playing, functions-ish. I think the key for Spurs will be how many of the big names can they actually get on the pitch, because I think one thing we have seen is that a team that really had balance and that really functioned only worked as long as all the regular starting 11 were there. As soon as Van der Vaart was gone for a few weeks, the system didn't quite work. Without Adebayor up front, I think it doesn't quite work either. When Bale's not playing, or Lennon's not playing, or both of them not playing, they're not the same, because they have to shift players who's very central out wide to do a job which they can't really do. So they need as much as of their first 11 on the pitch, and then they've got a really good chance. I think Chelsea are in a funny little spell, because they've obviously got Benfica coming up, and there was this optimism, I think, before the City game, but I think it'll only take sort of one half of a bad performance for the mood to shift again quite quickly.
Do you think it's that fragile?
Yeah, of course it is. You know, they might not get into the Champions League. I mean, that's a serious problem for a team like Chelsea.
But all the positive feelings of the removal of Andre Villas-Boas and the greater harmony between players and manager and all this?
I think, as I said, I think it's very, very fragile. It was all built on a game against Napoli, which probably Napoli should have really won or done enough to go through. And I think some of the performances were overhyped. And I think, as we saw to a certain extent last night, some of the key problems still persist. They haven't gone away. I mean, Lampard and Mikel and Matilde were completely overrun by a single guy, albeit his name was Yaya Toure. But still, I mean, that shouldn't happen to a team like Chelsea.
Also, Ivanovic going off in the City game and in doubt for this weekend. It's still Thursday lunchtime as we record this, but we don't know
for sure. You don't
really
want to see Bosingwa face up against Bale. Well, unless Bale doesn't play out wide and starts moving inside again.
Well, big questions, a big game for the weekend. Plenty more where that came from, and we'll be addressing some more of the Premier League weekend fixtures in part two. Well, I'll tell you what's hotting up, Paul. The battle against the drop. QPR, there they were in the bottom three yesterday. And imagine when they were 2-0 down at home to Liverpool, how bad their prospects look. In fact, a certain member of the Guardian Sports Test told me they were 750-1 to come back and win the game against Liverpool at that point. But they did.
They did.
You were there to witness history.
I was. And it 750-1 seems
apparently
very,
so, said Sean Ingle.
Well, they seemed generous, those odds, then, because they were being completely outplayed.
So what happened?
Liverpool collapsed. You have to praise QPR for the spirit that they showed and their never-say-die attitude. But they were given a big help by some slapstick Liverpool defending. And Liverpool started the game really well. For the first 20 minutes, they could have scored two or three goals. Luis Suarez's finishing again undid all his superb build-up play. QPR did get a bit of a foothold in the game, began to enjoy a little bit of possession, and it was surprising how meek Liverpool came. They started to retreat and sit very deep at the slightest sign of QPR resistance. And I put that down to two possible factors. One being confidence is still fragile there, even though they won the Merseyside Derby last week. They did have three defeats in a row before that. And secondly, there's a lack of pace in their midfield. So there's this fear that if they do commit too many forward, they won't be able to get back in time to stave off a counter-attack. Yesterday they had Kout, Adams, Spearing in midfield, and none of them have any speed. So I think that was it. And that gave QPR a little bit of belief. And they finished the first half on level terms, I'd say, and both in the scoreline and in terms of possession. Then Liverpool improved again the second half and went 2-0 in front deservedly and continued to create chances. Then when Sean Derry scored in the 77th minute from a header, Liverpool just collapsed and defended abysmally. Djibril Cisse equalised with a free header from 6 yards. And then Jose Enrique, who had a rare stinker of a game, made another ridiculous error to let Jamie Mackey in for the winner in stoppage time.
Jamie Mackey, who'd come on for Joey Barton, Joey Barton not happy about the
he wasn't happy, he wasn't happy about booing that he received, and QPR fans booed him because they haven't been happy with his performances recently. I guess you could say he sets himself up for this by having his say on all matters in society, and so people aren't slow to have their say on him, and given that he's repeatedly on £80,000 a week, they think he should be performing better. Yesterday, and he has admitted that it was the worst performance of his career, and it was actually quite comical. It looked like someone had sabotaged his boots, because every time he got the ball, it seemed to go in a different direction than the one he intended. And he was taken off and booed, and then went on to Twitter, obviously, to complain about being booed.
We had top
but it is a bit of a mystery, because he has been playing badly for a while, in my opinion. And I think that both John Wright Phillips and Akos Bizaki would have a stronger claim to a starting place than him at this stage. But I think he fits the Mark Hughes mould of a physical type of player in midfield. But I think QPR have enough of them already. They could do with Bizaki or Roy Phillips for the next game, I think.
Okay, well, a Rangers fan was posting and saying that top R's man, Michael Hann, suggested when he was last on the pod that QPR would only get 2 points possibly till the end of the season, but 3 big points in this game here and an unexpected fixture perhaps. What was the mood like among the fans at the end?
Well, at the end they were euphoric, and as was Mark Hughes and some of the players afterwards. They were all saying that this could be the spur they need to convince them that they can stay up. I mean, it's still unlikely, and you still have to take account of the fact that they were on course for defeat until that highly improbable capitulation by Liverpool. So that doesn't augur well, because they have to play the top four in their
top
remaining,
five even, yeah.
In the remaining nine matches.
Top five.
I know he scored, obviously, but I was just wondering what you made of Djibril Cisse.
He was okay. He scored. He went close with another long-range shot, and he put himself about. He was better than Jay Bothroyd, I think it's fair to say. I thought Bobby Zamora had a good game alongside him. He held the ball up very well, as he always does, and brought a lot of people into play. So they worked well together. In contrast, Luis Suarez, he could have done with one of those alongside him, because he was frequently isolated as in the periods where Liverpool were sitting deep, and because the other players couldn't get up to support him quickly enough. And then when Andy Carroll came on, he was still isolated.
but Kenny Dalglish explained that it was bad luck. He says that we had a lot of bad luck, and it's a tough life.
That's what he said when he was asked if Liverpool lacked concentration in the last 15 minutes. And he said, no, we didn't lack concentration. Give QPR some credit. They got the luck.
Right.
So that was him giving them credit.
It has been an appalling run of luck for Liverpool in terms of finishing all season, really. Might there be something more to it than simple misfortune? Do they need to go out and buy a new set of forwards, basically? Because this is a team that doesn't perform badly. It builds plenty of opportunities. It just never finishes.
Well, it's not necessarily about a new set of forwards. It's probably one new forward who can play alongside Suarez. Suarez is a great player who's putting in excellent performances. And you need to find someone, you know, I guess, you know, as Uruguay do, who can play alongside him and who can be the foil to him.
That leads to the big question, though. Would you trust Kenny Dalglish with their transfer fund?
Sounds like you wouldn't, Paul.
I wouldn't, no.
Right.
I think on the evidence of this season, no.
And that's where the real problem lies in many ways, because I think, you know, as a season, it's okay. They've done very, very well in the Cups, and I think the fans will probably settle for that. And even missing out on the Champions League is not a total disaster. But when it comes to strengthening the team, that would be difficult, because they've got 1 year before financial fair play kicks in. So they've already, in my view, looking at what they did over the last 18 months, have basically tried to bring that spending forward, invest it really heavily in anticipation of being a little bit more constricted further down the road. And there were some interesting comments, I think, not long ago saying, yeah, this will be more about one or two additions rather than wholesale new recruits, which is sort of managing the expectations of the fans that there won't be, you know, this whole influx of new players coming in. And they obviously need a bit more guy in midfield, I think. Of course, you've got Lucas Leiva coming back, but is he the answer to all the problems?
He has been a big miss, in fairness.
He has been a bit miss. That's undoubted. But I think it needs a bit more. But I'm not sure they'll be able to do that. So it's difficult. I mean, they're 3 points ahead of Swansea in the league, and they've scored 34 goals all season.
How many have Roy Hodgson's West Brom scored?
35.
Yeah, it's true. And that means something, doesn't it? Well, I'm not sure what it is. Roy Hodgson. Wait, Roy Hodgson, Liverpool. There's some connection there. Anyway, well, it was all very exciting, isn't it? People moving in, people moving out of that bottom three all week. Because before QPR staged their escape Wednesday night, you had Blackburn roaring out of the drop zone with a win over Sunderland. How about, Steve Keane? It's all set up for that Disney-esque happy finale at Ewood Park, where all the fans come down to the pitch and there's a big embrace and they freeze with a big cheesy
smile.
And
Venky's onus will be lifted on the shoulders.
Venky's are the new Mike Ashley.
There you go. So, Blackburn, and they have a huge match this weekend in the relegation battle against Bolton. Of course, this game was only recently cleared to continue because of the situation with Bolton midfielder Fabrice Muamba. And now they're remarkable. Not to say miraculous recovery. How someone can be dead for over an hour and then come back and talk normally. It's absolutely astonishing, and sure, we're all very grateful for that. But anyway, the game can go ahead, and Bolton could drag Blackburn Rovers back into the mire.
Yeah, I mean, I find the Blackburn thing a bit tricky to assess, because is it? I think actually last time I was on, Raph was making the same point about Arsenal suddenly being able to reassess their season as a great season getting into the Champions League. Is it now that because they were so awful before, we can say, oh, look, what a great achievement, when actually this squad isn't so bad, was good enough to beat Manchester United at Old Trafford? Maybe they shouldn't have been there in the first place, and maybe actually just scraping clear relegation wouldn't actually be such a huge achievement that we're now making it out to be for Steve Keane.
Steve Keane's 50 games in charge now, 12 wins, I think 24 losses. And you would wonder how many wins would, say, Sam Allardyce have had there. But to Gershon Port... What? Sorry.
I saw Sam Allardyce's West Ham on Tuesday, and I never want to see Sam Allardyce's West Ham again.
Tell us more about that game.
There's nothing more to say. Absolutely putrid.
Their championship automatic promotion campaign is faltering badly.
I hope so. I don't want to see them in the Premier League. They're awful to watch.
What was so bad about it?
It's fire the ball long from anywhere to Carlton Cole.
Right.
And hope for the best.
All right, then. Simple but effective.
It's not that effective, even.
To be fair, I think even our resident West Ham supporter, Jacob Steinberg, I get the impression off him that he doesn't want to watch too much more West Ham at the moment, so right. I don't think Paul's an isolated...
What was the mood like at Upton Park? Because it was a draw, no?
It was a draw, and the mood was rebellious, I think.
Oh, really?
The mood is never great at Upton Park, in fairness, when they don't win. He's put his faith in getting promoted by any means necessary, and the means are very ugly. And if he doesn't get the desired result, then scorn will be heaped upon him.
Right. 1-1 with Middlesbrough as well. So that's four games in a row at home they haven't won now. Is that right?
Five in a row. Yeah. First time in their history.
All right. Anyway, now also at the weekend in the battle at the bottom, QPR are at Sunderland, recently beaten by Blackburn. Liverpool host Wigan. Funny how this all ties together, isn't it? Wigan, who are putting points together here and there, still battling away, still down in the bottom three, but how many points are they off? Only three from safety. And then you've got, as I say, Bolton, Blackburn, and Norwich Wolves, hey? So you got, before it was any three from five, and they were all separated by about 2 points. Things beginning to open up a little bit now. A massive 6 points now between Blackburn in 16th place and Wolves at the very bottom. It seems pretty clear Wolves are destined for the drop. What do you think? The other two down there?
I don't know.
What?
It's just 3 points.
Yeah. They just don't look like they've got any.
No, they don't look like picking up any points, but it's still mathematically very possible.
Mm. All right. So
and
very
I believe you're probably safe this year with about 35 points.
All right.
So,
Okay.
Nine games to go.
So you think Wolves might stay up?
No.
All right.
I think they won't, unfortunately.
Wolves, Bolton and Wigan, currently the bottom three. We'll see what the weekend does about that. Right now, though, let's leave all this Premier League chat to one side and move on to Spain. Plenty to talk about this week with Sid. Sid Lowe.
Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Hi, Sid. Hi, Liga.
Very good. I like it.
Yeah.
Or hey, Liga. I imagine a load of horses surrounding it trying to...
That works equally well. I take your point. But anyway, high Liga in the sense that the Liga's back on. So much to talk with you about this week. Messi breaking the Barcelona scoring record and whether he's any good, all those kind of big questions. But also, this whole notion of Real Madrid. Now, the first time they drew and Barcelona eked a little bit closer, you thought, well, that's why they got all these points. In fact, you mentioned this, I think, on Monday's pod. But now that's two games in a row. Are they bottling it, Sid? And what happened on Wednesday?
Are they bottling it, I think, is a question that's possibly best answered more by the reaction to the result than the result itself. And I thought last night was extraordinary in a way, because I think Madrid showed, I thought, a lack of control, a lack of, I hate to use the word maturity, but I suppose maturity is the right word, a kind of a lack of serenity about it. That they concede this goal in the 82nd minute, which makes it 1-1, and there's a real sense of deja vu, and I'm sure that gets to them after the previous game. And we've another game in which we concede a free kick on the edge of the area, they score, it's 1-1, 4 points in 4 days. But there's 8 minutes to go still in the game against Villarreal. And Cristiano Ronaldo, I thought, was really interesting yesterday, because he reacted to it by trying to drag his team into the game. It's like the rest of his team abdicated, though, and in particular led by Mourinho. Madrid's reaction to the goal was within 2 minutes, Osil sent off, Mourinho sent off from the bench, Sergio Ramos sent off, all of them enabling Real Madrid, if you like, to say, well, look, the referee was against us. But actually, all of them coming after goal, so they don't explain the equaliser. What they do, to some extent, maybe explain is Real Madrid's then failure to turn the equaliser around against a team that were, frankly, pretty poor, Villarreal. And there was a sort of sense of meltdown about Real Madrid last night. I was really surprised by how wound up they let themselves get.
Did you wait in the car park for the referee, Sid?
No, he refused to talk to the media after the game, stormed out through the mix zone. Someone shouted at him, Mourinho, what happened? And he turned around and said, didn't you see? And then went and got on the bus. Now, didn't you see? Maybe we should talk about what he saw. The cards are Rui Faria, his physical coach, was sent off from the bench in the 48th or 49th minute. I don't really believe for a minute that losing your physical coach does your team any real damage.
Although
it is true that the referee was bizarrely obsessed, I thought, by what was coming from the bench rather than what was going on the pitch. But that may well be because he was getting an absolute volley all the way through the game. It's also Faria's fourth red card this season, so it does make you suspect, at the very least, that something funny is going on there, that he does have a bit of a mouth on him. Then you get this goal, and Madrid were furious about the goal because they felt that Altintop got the ball cleanly. Now, this is one of those challenges where I think in England it might not have been given, but in Spain it always would. Altintop went in, stud slightly up feet first, and I think got a bit of the ball first, but as he slid through, he lifted his leg up and effectively hooked the leg of Joan Oriol, who then went down. The refereeing experts, and I'll put that in very heavy speech marks, in the Spanish media have all said, well, it actually is a foul. So Madrid were complaining about a free kick that was a free kick. Also overlooking the fact that in the first half, Villarreal had two penalties turned down. And that then subsequently they get the red cards, or Silva clapping sarcastically. And I saw someone today make the point that, well, how does a referee know that he was being sarcastic? And I'm thinking, well, because he's not going to clap sincerely after Sergio Ramos has just got sent off, is he? So Osil was sent off for sarcastic clapping. Ramos was sent off one of those classic Ramos challenges when he gets angry and he just goes flying in and he goes to the ball, but he goes flying in with his legs and his arms all over the place in a kind of I'm in a mood now sort of approach, and got sent off as well. So then Mourinho got sent off first, trying to get the order right, by basically saying something about the profession of the referee's mother. So, frankly, I'm not convinced that Real Madrid had very much to moan about. But even if they did, I was surprised by how easily they allow themselves to get wound up and not to see the bottom line, which is they've still got a six-point lead, which is still huge, and I still think they'll win the league.
Yeah, but it's 4 points less than it was two games ago.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And of course, Madrid would have expected to drop some points between now and the end of the season. What they wouldn't have expected would have been for them to be at home against Malaga and away at Villarreal. But bear in mind, this is Villarreal. 1-1 drew at Villarreal, where Barcelona also drew 1-1. It's not beyond the realms of the possible. And, you know, it is partly because, as I said before, draws are the new defeats. But I was still struck by just how angry and just how wound up and just how anxious Madrid allowed themselves to get.
So do you think El Mundo Deportivo will dig out the crepometer that has been not been used for a while by the Madrid press and put it on
the
cover?
Well, funny you should say that. I think they probably will, not least because Sport... Let's clarify this for people. AS, one of the two Madrid-based newspapers, used this crapometer, the crapping yourself-ometer thing, to measure the amount of fear that Barcelona had. They said, look, they're terrified every time that Madrid got a little bit closer to them. Look, they're terrified. The other Madrid newspaper, Marca, invented a thing called Canguelo, which was their equivalent of this. And Canguelo is effectively the heebie-jeebies. You know, they've got the wobbles now because they needed something. It was nowhere near as good or as invented as the crapping yourself ometer, of course. So now the Catalan media have got to fight back, and Sport have started copying Marca, and they are now today on their cover saying, "We will win this league." Heebie-jeebies in Madrid. And actually, after last night's reaction, you can sort of understand them saying that. Although it's a bit rubbish that they complained about this word, and now they're copying it.
Yeah, it is. I love the jeebies, staying alive and all that. You make all sorts of kind of tie-ins with their music to this title race, especially because you say 6 points still ahead. But they've still got to play Barcelona, haven't they, Sid? Or have I missed something?
Well, this is the other thing in this whole package, this sort of storm that's going on around us with the league now, is that 6 points... which is really three. That's what everybody is saying. The assumption that Barcelona will beat Real Madrid in the Clásico. Well, first of all, they might not, because Real Madrid are quite a good side still. And secondly, because we may well be in a situation where Real Madrid go to the Clásico knowing that a draw is enough and make it very, very difficult for Barcelona. Even if they don't try and win, they can still stop Barcelona winning that game. And there are so many assumptions fed into the equation, and that's one of them. And I still think Madrid's position is very strong. I still think, you know, if Madrid were calmer about it, and that's why I'm so surprised, they would be saying, oh, 6 points clear, OK.
Mind you can understand why they're getting worried when they see the incredible Leo Messi racking up goals, racking up records there in the Catalan capital. So, 234 now. Is that right, or has it gone up since then?
I think that's right, 234. Yeah.
So he's broken the all-time record, and he's still 24. 5% of them with his head. Only 8 of those 234 goals against English sides. What does that tell us, Sid?
Oof, it tells us that Premier League is great and Messi's not that good after.
Well, I'm not saying anything.
Well, how many times have you played against English sides? I just wonder if the 4 against Arsenal are of any significance, or perhaps the 2 against Manchester United in Champions League finals are of any significance. Just wondering.
All right, well, you say that, Sid, but Formica Atomica posting it. saying, great achievement and everything for Messi, but meh. He's not even an Alvaro Acoba. That guy was a genius. Flawed, graceful, inconsistent and everything. I just kept coming back for more, waiting to see if he would be sublime or rubbish. Messi is a robot. He runs and runs. That's all he does very, very well. I don't get that edge of my seat thing with him as I did with Ronaldinho. Interesting.
I must admit, I have a certain degree of sympathy for that point of view, because I think Messi, in a way, has almost made people not talk about him as much as they might, because he does brilliant things so routinely now. It's like, yeah, well, whatever, another Messi goal, great, brilliant, let's move on. And it turns the old cliche on its head. Remember the old cliche that with you get, I don't know, for argument's sake, some Scottish player would score a brilliant chip and go, oh, if that was a Brazilian, we'd be talking about it for years. Or someone scores a great goal, oh, if Messi had done that, we'd all be bowing down to him. Actually, the opposite happens. Messi does it, oh, right, another Messi one, and we move on. And Messi does it week after week. So that does take away some of that kind of slight sense of excitement about it. I'd also agree that there is, while Messi is incredible to watch, there isn't the sort of the mad fantasy that there was about Ronaldinho. I don't think there have been many players that I've enjoyed watching as much as Ronaldinho. And he did stupid things. He did things that you go, how on earth? Not only how on earth did you do that, what on earth made you think of that, you absolute nutter? Hmm. And there were really great things. And in that sense, I can understand someone like Ronaldinho reaching people more maybe than Messi's relentless brilliance. You know, there are other people who would talk about Zidane because of the elegance and the grace in the way that he played. And different players reach people for different reasons. Obviously, none of these players are anywhere near as good as Matt Le Tissier, but that's another issue.
At last, we come to the truth. That's ever so interesting. What's happening this weekend? Where are Real going to drop points this time?
Real Madrid are at home against Real Sociedad. They shouldn't drop points in that. But of course, because of all the red cards and stuff yesterday, they'll be without Mourinho on the bench, which, given his slight hysteria last night, may not be a bad thing. He won't be on the bench.
No physio either.
Well, no physical trainer. It's not the same as physio.
Oh, is it not?
He's the guy that does the physical work with the team. The physio is obviously a doctor-style person.
So he's the coach? Sorry,
he's effectively the physical trainer amongst the coaches, yeah. So you've got a coach, you've got an assistant coach, you've got a goalkeeper coach, a physical coach. I think that might be it in the Real Madrid structure. Hang on. You've got
are referees allowed to send the doctor off?
Yes, and this is something that was being talked about in Spain. One of Mourinho's doctors got sent off last year. And first of all, obviously, the obvious question is a doctor should not be shouting abuse at a referee. He should not be. But the response to that was, look, this is ridiculous. You can come up with a punishment for him, but do not send him off. Because what if something terrible happens? And of course, you know, everything that's happened this week with Mwamba has made people in Spain say, look, this is another example of why we shouldn't ever send the doctor off. Anyway, sorry, you were asking about this weekend.
Yeah.
Barcelona go to Mallorca. I actually think, bizarre though this might sound, but that's the kind of game where they could drop points.
All right. Sounds like being another fascinating weekend. Look forward to speaking to you on Monday if you're around.
I hope I will be, yeah.
Good. Now, part three, more continental hijinks. We've got Rafael with the Bundesliga standing by. First, though, little bit of Serie A chat, Paolo Bandini, because big weekend in Catania and also in Florence.
Yeah, clamoroso al Cibali, the same as we hear pretty much every time Catania win a big home game. That'll be the same headline, which actually all goes back to a piece of commentary from the 1960s when they beat Inter and knocked them out of the title race in June, because that's how long seasons went on back then. Another spectacular result for this team, and under Vincenzo Montella, who obviously booted out by Roma over the summer. Actually, that result briefly took them level with Roma. Roma had a game in hand that they've just edged back ahead, but it's quite a significant achievement for a team that started the season with ambitions no higher than let's stay up. They're now level with Inter, only 3 points behind Roma, and Montella perhaps showing himself to be quite the manager.
Quite the manager, and he's so dishy as well. He is so dishy. Lovely chap too, but he just looks great. Yeah. And they are the second best performing team since the halfway point of the season. Yeah. Only Milan have been doing better. Meantime, though, lots of people posting about Juventus. Here's Charon, I might have pronounced that wrong, Charon Brad. How far has the signing of Andrea Pirlo been the reason behind Juventus' rejuvenation this season? Did other Serie A clubs miss a trick by not signing him on the short-term deal? Quite the week it's been for Pirlo and Juve.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a bit of a funny question in that who else was going to sign him? I mean, obviously Milan were the ones who had him. They chose to let him leave, and then
it could have been Inter.
He was
Inter before,
but I don't. Yeah, I don't know if that would have been as opportune a move for him as going to Juventus. So yeah, but he has. He's been pretty much the 140 class there for that team, the one sort of outstanding player outfield. And this is the big issue that everyone's been talking about with Juventus all season, and are still talking about, is the team is great. They work really hard. They've got a lot of solid players, but they are lacking a little bit of inspiration. That's why they had this run recently of 5 draws in 6 games. Where they need that actually is up front. They need someone who can do what Pirlo's doing for them in midfield.
Right. But Vucinic has come good just at the right point.
Well, yeah, you know, interestingly enough, Gazzetta today after the Coppa Italia game Tuesday night when they actually lost at home to Milan, but it's ended up drawing in extra time because they'd won the away leg 2-1, they lost the home leg 2-1. In extra time, Vucinic scored an absolutely stunning winner. So yes, entertainingly actually after that, Gazzetta called him a part-time fuoriclasse, which I think is about how most people feel about him at Juventus this season. He is such a good player when he wants to be, Mirko Vucinic, and he is such a poor player when he doesn't want to be. He's gone through whole phases this season where you wonder why he's even there, and then a few games, like the last 3-4 games, he's been brilliant.
Hey, it was brilliant on Saturday when they destroyed Florence in Fiorentina in Florence. Mm. It was kind of emblematic, his goal on Tuesday night, in fact, because it was in extra time and things had been going on for a certain while, and the ball just came to him and he was stood about 30 yards out and he just kind of looked at it and just whacked it in, but from just dead stands to almost like, I've had enough of this.
It was actually quite Ibrahimovic-esque, sort of fittingly, since they're up against Milan. It was that moment of, I'm bored now, I'm just going to do something brilliant. But it was a fantastic goal.
Anyway, there you go. So they are now through to the Coppa Italia final with Napoli.
Yeah, well, actually, I think this is, it's a great setup because Napoli haven't won a trophy for 22 years now, and they haven't been in a final for 15 years. Juventus haven't won a trophy other than Serie B since Calciopoli. So for them, it's their first sort of post-Calciopoli opportunity to win something. It feels like a great final. And actually, you've got to say in that both teams have rotated players. They haven't fielded their strongest teams in the cup. We had Del Piero playing again, scored the first goal for Juventus, who doesn't get a look in the league at the moment. And actually, I think some people might say that might be one of the reasons why they have drawn so many games. They could probably do with that little bit of class that he can bring. But yeah, it's really nicely set up for the cup final, and also really nice set up in the league for this weekend when they play Inter.
Mm, so Juve play Inter, Milan are playing Roma. Roma won on Monday night against Genoa, and they're still almost ish in the race for a Champions League place. It was really nice to see Del Piero on the field in the starting lineup and scoring. Really nice to see as well, not just the game, a terrific atmosphere there at the Juventus Arena. Flags, fans, whole place absolutely stracolmo, packed to the rafters. It looked almost like a Bundesliga game, Raphael. Is there higher praise than that? I'm not sure. A quick question before we get on to the Bundesliga. Richard Hall posting it. What does the realistic spending capacity of Inter look like this summer, Paolo?
The Inter situation, I really am going to be interested to see how this shakes out with financial fair play, because they are losing so much money. When you look over the last 5 seasons, I think they've lost something like €665 million, and that's including the season when they won the Champions League, and they made, I think, €67 million or so in Champions League revenue that year. They still posted a loss of €69 million that year. So they are losing so much money. And if they don't have the Champions League, then they were.
Yeah,
I mean, and they've got the highest wage bill in Serie A. It's close to €200 million a year. They've got so much to resolve there. And Moratti sort of talked about it a lot, and he's tried to convince the fans that this needs to happen. But the problem is, it's like he hasn't convinced himself, because what he does is he has sort of refused to make the big signing since Schneider. He's refused to sort of go in and buy the sort of big player that they're looking for. But then what happens is he gets, like this year, to the middle of the year, to January, and things aren't going well, and he just brings in a whole bunch of other players on not insignificant wages and stacks the squad with even more players who are going to make this problem worse in the long run. So it's a real mess at Inter, and I think that's, again, this is going to be, they may not get into Europe this season the way they're going at the moment, but if they do get in, it's going to be very interesting with Inter over the next few years to see how strong UEFA are willing to be about
If they're not in Europe, they don't have to worry about it. that's a point.
That could
be the strategy, actually. But, fair enough.
But actually, just quickly, I thought it's just one of those random stats, but I thought it was a vaguely noteworthy one for this weekend's Derby d'Italia. After 28 games last season, Inter was second with 56 points and Juventus were seventh with 41 points. This season, that is exactly reversed. Juventus second on 56, Inter seventh on 41.
Wow. Okay. Now, Raphael, I should just mention Mesba's bullet diving header against Juventus. That's for Lawan Hawitsi. You're absolutely right. We've been giving him a lot of stick, and he actually scored for Milan.
And it wasn't a bad goal either, that one. That was a quite great diving header.
But wasn't Mesba. He the player who missed Del Piero on the Juventus Open? I think he was.
Very
but anyway,
possibly.
Hey, while we're on the subject of Inter, let's give them a little bit of good news, any Interisti out there, because their Primavera squad, the under-19s, has been busy in the next-gen competition. You know, the under-16 sort of, it's been described as the kind of junior Champions League thing. 16 teams from around Europe competing in this. And they, this week, made it through to the final. In fact, I think it was the semi-final was last night, played at Brentford, bizarrely. They beat Marseille, completely dominated the game, apparently, 2-0, the scoreline. And they're going to be taking on Ajax in the final at Leighton this Sunday. Ajax, who beat Liverpool 6-0 in their semi-final. And before that, do you know who they played in the quarter-final, Paul? Barcelona. And they beat them 3-0.
And most excitingly of all, James,
yes,
in the Inter Primavera squad.
Tell us.
I don't believe he's actually played a game in this cup run, unfortunately. One of my cousins, Andrea Bandini.
Andrea Bandini.
Yeah, but I don't think he's played in this run, so I probably have given him a big up there at the wrong moment.
Well, hey, anyway, there you go. It's going to be at the Leighton, the Matchroom Stadium, I think it's called, Leighton's Ground, on Sunday afternoon. I don't think you can watch it on TV. Now, it wasn't just Italy that had big cup action during the week, was it, Raphael? Also in France, there were some interesting games too.
There were.
Yep.
Yes.
And in the German Cup.
Yes. A pair of really amazing games.
What happened?
The first one, Tuesday, Greuther Fürth, who are the leaders of the second division and who were very likely to go up next season, they played Borussia Dortmund, the leaders of the first division. And it was a great game. There weren't actually any goals of 118 minutes, but it was really hotly contested, very, very intense, a classic cup match.
So who went through?
Well, hold on a second.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Then, with penalties approaching, Mike Buskins, the Greuther Fürth coach, had a great idea to bring on the second goalkeeper, because this guy, Yasmin Fejcic, is about 2 meters tall and looks frightening and apparently is very good at saving penalties. So to bring him on just to unnerve the opposition a little bit. Unfortunately, Dortmund still had time for one last shot at goal, which went off the post, back to Fejcic's back and into the goal.
And if he'd not been so tall, it might not have bounced back that way.
Might not have been.
What is this team called again? Greuther Fürth?
Greuther Fürth, yeah.
What does that mean?
They're a big side. They're actually the favourite side of Henry Kissinger.
Are they?
Because he is from Fürth originally.
Oh, okay.
But there's a big fallout afterwards because Kevin Grosskreutz, who is a Dortmund midfielder, but also sort of a Dortmund ultra in shorts, the biggest Dortmund fan you can think of, then went on and sort of celebrated in front of the third fans, which is a little bit iffy because, you know, they're a second division team and you're like, you know, you just went through on the last shot of goal with Ilkay Gundogan scoring and then rubbed it in. And he went over to Gerard Asamoah, who had 12 years at Schalke and who's no friend of Dortmund whatsoever, and sort of celebrated in his face. And afterwards, there was an alleged incident of racism as well. Kevin Grosskreutz said to insult Asamoah, but this being Germany, this is all like, yeah, whatever. I'm sure they didn't mean it. And Jürgen Klopp, the Dortmund coach, said, it's not really important what you say, it's important what you think. And I can assure you that Kevin Grosskreutz is no racist.
What happened in the other semi-final?
The other semi-final was Bayern against Gladbach, the Gladbach side who'd beaten them twice already this year. So really, they're a bogey team. And again, they made it really, really difficult. No goals, also 120 minutes. Yet another really great game. Lots of chances. And then they famously played each other in the 1984 German Cup final. And Lothar Matthäus, who just signed to move to Bayern the next season, was the first penalty taker for Gladbach. And he skied it over the bar. And this is something that's never really been forgotten, because next year he played in the Cup Winners' Cup with Bayern. They wouldn't have been in Europe otherwise. Now you had a situation, all the Bayern players scored, and then Dante, who's a Brazilian, who is very much rumoured to have already agreed a deal to go to Bayern, stepped up, and guess what happened? Skied it over the bar.
No.
Yes.
Wow.
This ultimately didn't prove to be the one decisive penalty, just like Lotus was only one of two misses, but still, it made for a quirky coincidence.
It certainly does. So there you got Bayern and Borussia Dortmund in the final.
Yes, the dream final, May the 12th, and they play each other only a couple of weeks before in the Bundesliga. So Bayern were, I think, 4 points clear going into winter break. Mm-hmm. So Dortmund, yeah, they've pulled away to a certain extent. They drew against Augsburg last weekend. That's why Bayern have made up a bit of ground. And of course, it's still very feasible, but you just think that Dortmund have a bit more when it comes to grinding out results. They're very much the Juventus of the Bundesliga. I mean, they're not that exciting in terms of individual players, at least not this season, because Götze, for example, is not playing he's been injured a lot. But they get the results, and they seem to be a bit like a machine, whereas Bayern score 7 goals 1 week and then look very average the next. But certainly at the moment, Bayern very much have the momentum behind them, and it's going to be make for a fascinating end of the season.
Is Goetze's, is his value, I don't know, is he diminished at all by the fact they're doing so well with him being absent this much?
I'm not sure his value is diminished, but I think his value is a strange one to assess objectively, because he's got a young kid who's very, very talented. I mean, he is probably the most talented of all the German players, perhaps has got more talent than Özil, everyone else. If you just look at the sort of the raw quality that he brings, looks like they're not quite up at his level. But the guy is only 19. Mm. He's only played 2.5 seasons, really, as a full Bundesliga player. He's been very inconsistent this year. Mm. Now he's injured. I think it's a huge gamble to go and say, you know, we're going to meet a price that will compel Dortmund to sell, which will be around about 30 million euros. I think it's not a straightforward proposition. He's worth it in a way, because the potential is there. But do you really want to spend all that money on the potential? I'm not sure.
More or less potential than Andy Carroll?
It's slightly more potential.
Okay. All right. Good. All right, well, that brings us to the end of today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks to guest producer Ian, to Paul Doyle, Paolo Bandini and Raphael Honigstein. We'll be back with more on Monday. There'll also be a pay-per-view up on Friday on The Guardian and iTunes, if you like. But for now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
Guardian Podcasts, sponsored by audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/free download, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.